So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Man here with The Modern Man. And g'day, Andrew in Melbourne, who says, Ollie, I very much enjoyed last week's show, although I have a sort of complaint. Every time you and Ollie Peart spoke to Siri, my iPhone paused the episode. Eventually, I had to resort to headphones so Siri couldn't hear you. I wonder how many other Man fans had Siri, Echo, or Google confused by your experiments with voice activation. Many, Andrew, according to my mailbox. Debs says, Ollie, my husband is convinced you deliberately tried to activate Siri as often as possible in the zeitgeist last week. It kept overriding my maps whilst I was driving to an unfamiliar part of Leeds. And Lee, the osteopath, says, I found my phone regularly pausing the podcast after picking up the Google commands. This was hilarious until Google Maps thought I wanted rerouting to Findon. I can't think what we said that sounded like Findon. But look, Lee, it's a historic town. It's where the Doomsday Book was completed. Why not take a detour on us? Follow the brown signs. Good news, though, from Giles from Northampton, just down the road from Findon, in fact. He says, Ollie, I develop Alexa skills and have started work on a Modern Man skill for you. How exciting is that? So in a few weeks' time, it should be possible, Man fans, Giles is going to keep me posted on this, but it should be possible to ask your Amazon Echo to play an episode of our show without it bringing up Old Men on a Mountain or The Muffin Man. So thank you, Giles. And thank you as well for pointing out that you're not just motivated by altruism. I didn't know this. But apparently one of the reasons people make Alexa skills is that if they get certified and attract enough downloads, then you get freebies. He says he's had a free Echo Dot and an Amazon Christmas bauble. If you want to check out some of Giles's previous work, he says he's the designer of the What Is My Dog Thinking skill. So if you ask Alexa what your dog's thinking, it will give you a phrase your dog might be thinking right now. The What Is My Cat Thinking skill. I'd be terrified to actually know what my cat is thinking. She's a psychopath. And Name of Thrones. That is Giles' skill, which generates a random Game of Thrones-sounding name. All terribly useful stuff, I think we can agree. What a time to be alive. This week's middle feature is the life story of an Australian guy called Manny. He was born into ultra-Orthodox Judaism and then suffered sexual abuse at his religious school. So his story gives both a fascinating glimpse into a very insular community you rarely hear from in the media, yet is also depressingly familiar from other stories we know, particularly with regards to the Catholic Church. So, content warning, the interview does include descriptions of his abuse and the trauma thereby, but he's a great speaker, very compelling, searingly honest, and I think his experience really sheds light on the fact that this kind of abuse and the cover-up afterwards, it happens everywhere, it always follows a pattern, whichever institution you find it in. It's well worth listening to. Also on today's show, you will learn exactly what happens in Peterborough at 11:15 on a Friday night. You will learn what Cyndi Lauper might put on her privates, and you'll learn which app you need to download to stop yourself looking at apps. Let's go. On this week's Modern Man.
I'd be playing basketball in the backyard, and because he was in charge of security and had access to all the offices and all that, he was just always around.
Closure and disclosure. Surviving abuse in a tight-knit community.
If you just use the weight of your hands to drag your jaw down.
And Alex Fox pays lip service to tipping the velvet. But first, it's the Zeitgeist, all the trends you need to know about for the week ahead, with a man who as a child sang at Slough Football Ground. It's Ollie Pitt.
Got a standing ovation?
Did you?
Yeah.
Sympathy. What are the big trends this week?
Fortnite. Drake and Ninja sat down to a spot of Fortnite on Twitch the other week. I'm going to show you what it is. Watch this.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I forgot you guys can't hit each other. Yo, Drake, if you hit the circles when you're farming, it does twice as much.
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of supplies. Materials.
Okay, looks like Doom, but it's outside, and a man's walking around with, what is that, a chisel or a gun, and he's hitting things. It's a video game. What's special about it?
So Fortnite is now the most watched game on Twitch.
Is Twitch that video platform? Yeah. Well, we challenged you, didn't we, to narrate live video games?
Yeah, so it's basically a platform where gamers can broadcast themselves live playing a computer game.
Yeah.
And there's a chap called Ninja, who used to play a game called Player Unknown's Battlegrounds. And recently, he swapped to this game, Fortnite. And the reason he swapped is because Fortnite released a version of their game called Battle Royale. Now, a Battle Royale is when up to almost 100 players are dropped in the same game and the last one standing wins.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that this format of gaming is hugely popular.
How do you play it, though? I don't even know how you play it. Is there a website? How do you get on
it?
You
can play it online, yeah, for free on your PC, PlayStation 4, Xbox, or on a Mac. Yeah.
So that's okay. So your trend, basically, is not that there's a new game in town. It's that this idea of battle royaling any existing format might cause it to become more popular.
Yeah, so the PlayerUnknown's Battleground, that previous game that I mentioned, when they released their battle royale version of the game, it was the most successful game. Like, this was the game that people wanted to watch and the game that people wanted to play when it came to sort of live streaming and that kind of thing.
So, and does that show that actually, in these MMOs and open world games and everything, that really, when everyone was telling us that the only limit was your imagination, it's all about, you know, following your own path and not having to deal with rules and, you know, explore open worlds, really, there's still a human desire for there to be one ultimate winner?
I think so. And also, because of the way that those games operate, it's not like a traditional game where you have an end goal and you win and you complete a level.
Yeah, it's gone forever.
It changes every time. So every time you enter a Battle Royale game, it's completely different because you're playing completely different people.
And did money change hands for Drake to play this game?
As far as I know, it was simply a promotional thing.
Seems unlikely.
No, because Ninja...
He's genuinely cool.
Ninja, this online gamer guy, he used to play a game called Halo. Have you heard of that game?
Mm.
Professionally. He used to get paid to do it. But he realised that streaming online through Twitch was far more lucrative financially for him to do it. And his audience is huge. Like, it is massive. You're talking about millions of people watching simultaneously him play games.
So, in other words, Drake may have gone on his channel promotionally in the same way he might play on the Graham Norton show. But there's still a benefit for him. He's still trying to sell records by playing a video game.
Sure, but he's appealing to, like, 12 to 15-year-olds.
Okay. Right, what else have you got for us this week?
Poop per face.
Excellent.
China is a very technologically advanced nation.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, they've taken an active interest in facial recognition technology.
Right.
The latest incarnation of which is to dispense toilet paper in public toilets.
So is this like they recognise that the last time I went for a poo, I used 3 sheets rather than 5 and dispensed the correct amount?
Yes, exactly that, according to The Atlantic.
Surely not.
What?
Because I just made it up and it's ridiculous.
No, I'm absolutely serious.
What, I mean, what's the purpose of that?
Well, you go into a public toilet and assuming...
No, you're just saying what I said, but what's the point?
Because toilet paper costs a lot of money, right? They'll only dispense, according to The Atlantic, 23.6 inches per person per poop.
Okay, so this isn't about customisable amount of dispensing paper. It's about a restriction on the amount of paper each person can use. So they can say, no, he's had 20 sheets already this week.
Yeah, but not weekly. So it will just be on that occasion. So if you go in and you just had a bout of, you know, a slightly dodgy tummy.
I think we're all on the same
page.
And
you went back in 10, 20 minutes later, it would say, please try again later.
No, it wouldn't.
It would. It would. That is what happens.
But then you would have poopy pants.
It would. Well, yeah, exactly.
But what would be... Why? What's the benefit of that to anyone?
Well, because they're saving money on loo paper.
You rightly deserve to have that toilet paper if you need it to wipe your bottom.
Well, in all honesty, I think the real reason is probably much darker. So they have other uses for fecal
recognition.
They have other uses for
really
fecal
be,
recognition.
It should be a camera recognises each anus.
Yeah, but they use it for other things as well. They've recently put it in place to stop people from jaywalking. It doesn't just capture you and then you get sent a fine. It takes your photo. It takes your video, and within 20 minutes, it knows who you are, and it displays the video of you committing the violation and your ID, like your citizen's ID, on a big screen. You're publicly shamed. And you get the option at that point to pay a fine of around $3, do a half-hour course in traffic rules, or spend 20 minutes assisting a policeman in controlling traffic.
Oh my god, 20 minutes assisting a policeman. Definitely. Obviously. I'd pay to do that anyway.
I would literally commit the violation just
especially
for that.
If you're actually involved in penalising people for breaking traffic rules. I mean, that's a prize. I'd love to send that to my own house and everyone who goes over 36 miles an hour.
You could do it. There's a woman that does it with a hairdryer. Why don't you just do that?
What?
Have you not seen that?
No.
There's a woman that stands outside her house with a hairdryer pointing at traffic so the traffic slows down.
Yes, but she's obviously insane. I'm not talking about using a household implement and pretending that it's a traffic device. I'm saying I'd like to contribute to the some knowledge of my local police station and get offenders who are speeding outside my house.
Well, you're a good citizen. You should probably move to China.
Yes, I'm not sure those two things go together, but okay.
But they're using it for a much bigger reason. The government are actually launching a program called the Social Credit System. The idea is that you accumulate credits for good behaviour and you lose credits for bad behaviour.
Like a credit score.
Exactly. But in real world situations.
Right, and you just told me that I should go and live in China.
Well, you'd do all right because you'd be there going, oh, he's speeding, just, you know, discrediting all those untrustworthy losers.
Okay, well, it's time for you to feedback on your response to last week's challenge. I must say that you don't look bruised.
No.
I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
Last week, Manfan Brett challenged you to take up para ice hockey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how did it go?
I got asked to turn up to an ice hockey rink in Peterborough at about 11:15 at night on Friday.
Why do they train at night?
It is literally the only time they can get on the ice. And they can only get, at the moment, they can only afford an hour every 2 weeks on the ice. And that's the only time they can get it, at 11:30 till 12:30.
What?
Yeah.
Is it the only time at the weekend, maybe? On a Tuesday at 7 o'clock in the morning.
No, they can't get it any other time. That's the only time they can get it. And the guys, there's very few places that do para ice hockey across the country, but it means that they drive from miles and miles around. So you've got people arriving at 11:30 at night on a Friday, and then they're leaving at 12:30, and they might do, some of them drive 2.5 hours to get there.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So what do they do when they get there?
So I saw a load of people in full ice hockey regalia. Uh-huh. You know, all the pads, the whole lot, the helmets, all that kind of thing. And I met a girl called Naomi, who basically is the chairman of the team. She looks after all the stuff, makes sure they got all the right equipment. And she told me a little bit about the kit that they have, because it is slightly different from ice hockey. The first thing you notice is they don't have the long sticks, obviously. They got two short sticks. They're probably about 2 feet long, and then on one end they've got a spike, a very sharp spike, that you can stab yourself with if you're not careful. And in games sometimes people might, I'm not saying they do it every time, but they might deliberately give you a little jab.
Really?
Yeah, been known to happen.
What is the thing, because you mentioned this when I immediately sort of last week suggested this idea, your first response was, oh, people hit each other in ice hockey. Is that really a thing?
That is an actual thing. So I've seen two ice hockey games in my life, one in Denmark, which is, it's their national sport, and one in the United States. And both times I saw fights. And the one in the States, it was like, right, a fight kicked off, and they give an allocated time slot for them to basically punch each other in the face. And then they stop it. But you're allowed to do it.
What?
And that was a friendly game. So you got these two sticks, and then you're on a sledge. And on the sledge, it's not like a normal toboggan where you've got two rails running either side, like a foot apart or anything. You literally have a single blade at the bottom that just sits just underneath your bum. So you're sat with your legs sticking out right in front of you and you've got this blade under your bum. But because I was new and hadn't done it for very long, I had two blades, probably about 4 inches apart.
Okay, so you were on a starter sledge.
I was on a starter sledge. And then your legs are out in front and then they're strapped onto a bar that's on the front. So you can't move your legs. What they say is that if you're able-bodied, you can play this as well, because when you're out on the ice, actually, it completely democratizes the situation.
Everybody's equal, yeah, because you're just using your arms to power yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, actually, what was the nature of most of the players' disability, or could you not tell?
Yeah, there was a real mix. So there was an amputee there who had a serious motorbike accident. There were serious spinal injuries, and there was a chap who had polio when he was growing up. It led to him having a disability when he's older. Right. So a real mix. When I was out on the ice, I could totally see why these people did it, because, oh my God, like, they are hurtling along so fast.
So how did
fast.
You fare?
I can show you.
Oh, have you got a video?
I've got a video.
Oh, amazing.
So this is me here, the one in the black. right?
So on, you see I'm on the right.
On the right. Yeah. You see I'm propelling myself.
Yeah. Oh, you're ahead.
Yeah, yeah, doing all right.
Yeah.
And then got to go for the puck. Completely miss it.
Oh, there's the puck.
I'm down.
Yeah, oh,
I'm down.
On your face in the corner of the ring.
Yeah.
Did that hurt?
No, but there was one occasion where you sort of like, I went round, and because I got the two blades on my one, so I go and try and make a turn, and the blade dug in, and I flipped over, and the stick went like that, and I felt the spike at the bottom go into my abdomen, and it luckily, it just sort of like skimmed off a bit. But it, I just thought, he could seriously... I wasn't wearing pads, so they had to go easy on me. And the way they hit those pucks, right? That puck hit me in the chest. That's a broken sternum.
Yeah, I wouldn't want a broken sternum at midnight on a Friday in Peterborough.
No.
Okay, time for your challenge for this week. Ollie Pitt, open the digital envelope.
Okay. Alan says, I run a small business and I need to find an innovative way to advertise for a small amount of money.
I feel your pain, Alan.
So I'd like to challenge Ollie to get his face in the most impressive place for £100? Question mark?
Yeah, it's a good challenge.
But just my face?
Well, he doesn't specify, does he?
He said impressive.
He did, yes.
But what does he mean by that?
Well, that's
side of an aeroplane?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I want you to get your face in the most preposterous place by this time next week. I mean, ideally a billboard in the centre of town somewhere, but I'll take a digital screen.
Just my face.
Just your face. Where can you get your face, but for a budget of £100? If you think you can help Ollie get his face somewhere that you're involved with... Yeah. Sounded wrong, but you know what I mean. For example, like if you...
A tattoo on someone's back.
Yeah, I guess.
I'll give someone £100 to do that.
Yeah, I'd give someone £100 to put a tattoo of you on their back. Yeah, absolutely. That's quite renegade. I was thinking more like perhaps you work for a local arts centre and you've got a spare billboard outside. But sure, tattoo on a back, fine.
That's not impressive, is it?
If you think you can help. No, but it's quite amusing, isn't it, if you end up in, you know, Yeovil Puppet Theatre. Anyway, whatever. If you think you can help, then get in touch through our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. And if you've got a challenge for Ollie for next week's show, do the same. Good luck, Ollie.
Thanks.
I look forward to seeing you around.
You will.
Everywhere.
Hello, Man fans. I'm Tony Wrighton. I'm a Sky Sports presenter and a specialist in NLP, that's neuro-linguistic programming. And these are my life hacks on how to be more motivated with NLP. You may be wondering what the hell NLP is. It's a very long name for a set of techniques that is used by millions of people around the world in therapy, communication, sales, productivity. Think of it as neuro-hacking, and that'll give you an idea of what it's all about. Tip number one, so to be more motivated, it's all about chilling out and maximizing your downtime so you can maximize your uptime. And the way I do that is meditation. And don't worry, you don't have to go to a meditation retreat in the jungle to do this. You can just sit quietly for a few minutes each day. Tip number two, links to the first. It's putting the tech away and smelling the roses. We check our smartphone 110 times a day on average. And me, I put mine away and I switch everything off for at least 2 hours a day. And almost always it's the best 2 hours of my day. So put the tech away. These tips are really about maximizing your downtime. You know, we live in a state of constant overstimulation. We've got so much to entertain ourselves that we're never at our most productive, at our most creative, and our most relaxed. So if you maximize that downtime and chill out a little bit more, then when it comes to switching on and having the big ideas and being more productive, you'll have more energy and motivation to do it. Tip number three, when you do come back online, there's an app called Freedom that helps you stop frittering away hours every day on, I don't know, The Guardian or Facebook or WhatsApp or whatever it is. You install Freedom on your phone and you can ban certain apps and websites at certain points during the day. It works for me anyway. Well, for more information, you can listen to my podcast, which is Zestology, and you can also check me out on Sky Sports.
Now, how big is your family? Perhaps you have two sisters or brothers or three. I've got none. I'm an only child. Well, Manny Wax grew up as one of 17 children. He was an ultra-Orthodox Jew, part of the Chabad sect in Melbourne, Australia, and his family lived across the street from the Yeshiva Centre, a religious school where all his education and all his extracurricular activities took place. It was a tight-knit community you rarely hear from in the mainstream media. I started by asking him what a typical day in his childhood looked like.
Well, you wake up in the morning. I would have had already a responsibility for a younger sibling. In my case, it would have been maybe a 2-3-year-old. I would have been responsible for changing their nappies. The older children, you need to make sure that they do homework, prepare lunch for school, going to synagogue, of course, first thing in the morning. Before that even, you would go to immerse yourself in a mikveh, a male ritual bath, to cleanse yourself both physically and spiritually. And then from there, you go to the synagogue, pray, then to school. And of course, within the school, there was religious studies for the first 3-4 hours in the morning. And then for the remainder of the day, about half or a little bit more than half, we had general studies as well, maths, English, science, the basics. But the emphasis clearly was much more on the religious studies and the religious context and environment. If the Lubavitcher Rebbe suddenly decided to give a speech from New York, we used to run to synagogue and have a listen to the live hookup from New York.
And presumably prayers throughout the day, right? Prayers for washing your hands, prayers for eating, prayers for drinking.
Minimum 100 blessings a day is expected.
Wow.
And I mean, look, if you just pray the morning prayers, which, mind you, includes thank you, Lord, for not making me a woman, and thank you, Lord, for not making me a Gentile, by the way. So once you get through those, the morning prayers, you've probably got a solid 50-odd blessings already. And then each time you eat, before you eat, after you eat, go to the bathroom. After the bathroom, wash your hands, you got to say a blessing. 100 blessings is easy.
Now, you were born into that, so you didn't know any different. But what was your instinct about it?
It was very natural. I mean, we grew up indoctrinated that our sole purpose in life was to bring the Messiah. That's it. The way we bring the Messiah is through worshipping God. And in some ways, more importantly even, was to almost worship the Lubavitcher Rebbe. For us, he was a godlike figure. If you go to Chabad houses around the world, you will see massive photos of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, even though he has passed on, you know, since 94. So
it's not like the Pope. There's not a new one.
No.
It was the one man who really brought the Lubavitch to a more mainstream wider sect.
That's correct. There are, I mean, within Chabad, since he passed away, there are different streams. Mainly there are those who still believe he's the Messiah and going to resurrect himself almost, which is a very un-Jewish type of approach. But then there are others who believed that he had the potential to be the Messiah, as we believe in ultra-Orthodox Judaism, that in every generation there is the potential, one person is the potential to be the Messiah. There are 36 secret tzaddikim, holy men, and they are men only, of course. So it was really about doing everything we could to be better people and to do kindness and good deeds for the sake of bringing the Messiah, so that we will be worthy of receiving him. It wasn't just about us and us becoming better. It was at least on the same level to go and reach out to other Jews around the world or around us to try to bring them closer to Judaism. So Judaism isn't a proselytizing religion, but if you're Jewish, that's all Chabad cares about, and they will try to get you to do as many mitzvot, as many commandments as they can for the sake of bringing the Messiah. And I remember when we'd come back after finding someone who'd never put on tefillin, phylacteries, and he's, you know, 50 years old. There's a certain word for it, which I forget what we say in Hebrew, but we'd come back after, even from a very young age, 8, 9, 10, walking for miles to do these types of activities. And we'd come back and say, I got someone who's never put on tefillin today. We'd get together and have a lechaim, you know, not as an 8-year-old, but as a 13 or 14-year-old, and celebrate that because, wow, that's going to be a step, massive step forward to bringing the Messiah closer.
So actually your job would be to find people like me. I was born into Judaism. I've now married someone who isn't Jewish. I'm not practicing, but from the Chabad point of view, I could still be part of the next Messiah.
I would be sitting here, if I was a Chabad Jew, trying to make Judaism as attractive as possible for you to possibly find something good in it and interesting, so that you will take something and start practicing in your home and your environment with the expectation that you will see so much beauty in that, that you will become, you'll want to join us almost.
Were you happy? If I'd have asked you when you were 9 years old, what would your answer to that
question be? At the age of 9, 10, yes, I would have been very happy because my life seemed very fulfilling. It's really about community, love, affinity, looking after each other, especially when you're a 9, 10 years old, 10-year-old child who doesn't really know what's going on.
And then it was as part of being at Chabad in, what's the name of the religious school that you went to?
The Yeshiva Center.
The Yeshiva Center, right.
It's so, Yeshiva College. The Yeshiva Center was synagogue, had a number of different organizations under it. And the Yeshiva College was the school for the boys and Beth Rivka College for the girls.
And so it was in that environment, in the Yeshiva, that your abuse began.
Talk me through that, because sadly there wasn't just one abuser, but talk me through the first.
It was, yeah, always a difficulty to know where exactly to start, because, you know, there's always the grooming process that happens, which I've now come to learn. It's not as if, you know, growing up, what they taught us so much about this issue of dangers, but just stranger danger. So if it was anything about warning kids about potential dangers, it was be careful of people you don't know. Mm. Don't get into a car with a stranger. Whereas in the Jewish community, in our community, there's no such thing as stranger danger, because as long as you have a beard, a kippah, a hat, someone who looks like you, he's a pious Jew, he cannot harm you. Mm. So it was in that context where Volvel Zarubansky, who was the son of a rabbi, one of the most senior rabbis of Chabad in Australia, and he used to read the Bible in synagogue, in my synagogue, every Shabbat, every Sabbath. And we went through a grooming process without going into the details. But then on one night during a Jewish festival of Shavuot, which is customary to stay up all night to study the Bible or religious text, even as a young boy, I would have been about 11 or 12 years old. So this would have been about 87. I wanted to have a rest upstairs. It was about 1 a.m. All the men were staying up downstairs, and upstairs was the ladies' section. None of the women were there because it's only for men to stay up. I went to lie down, and I realized someone was following me. I realized it was him soon after. And for some reason, I sensed something was wrong. Obviously couldn't put anything together, because, again, talking about education, there was no sex education. There was no body safety discussions. So, you know, and certainly not anything happening by people in your community who look like you and are part of that. So I went to lie down, rest. I found a spot. I remember actually someone was, another child, 2-3 years older than me, was lying down. So instead I could have gone anywhere. I went actually very closely to him. Again, I thought it was probably a defense mechanism in some ways. And then I shut my eyes quickly, pretending almost to be asleep, but knowing full well that he would know that I'm not asleep. And he came and kneeled down beside me, and which I saw soon after when I opened my eyes. But he started stroking me on my legs, worked his way up, and touched me on my genitalia and on the clothes only. He started unbuckling me and was molesting me. And then he got some sort of guilty feeling that and said, "This isn't appropriate for a place like this," meaning that somehow it was okay to do it, but just not inside a synagogue. And he basically asked me to follow him, and we went to the women's bathroom. Again, no one was there. And the abuse deteriorated much more. And
what were you thinking when he said, "Come with me to the women's bathroom"?
I remember that I just froze when he started touching me, molesting, you know, even on the leg. It was, I knew something was wrong, but I had no language and no thought about what exactly was going on. So I remember just freezing and just lying down and hoping something will stop. And eventually I remember opening my eyes and just seeing what was going on. Obviously felt very uncomfortable. I remember my stomach feeling all sick, but I kind of also, when he said that, I went just like like a robot. He said, "I followed."
That's because when you said you wanted to, you know, not dwell on the grooming process, actually, I am curious how it's possible for someone to persuade you to follow them to be abused unless the grooming process has been really quite meticulous. I'm curious what he did to get you into that position.
Look, what we now know is part of the grooming process for any perpetrator, most perpetrators, is that they find the vulnerabilities and what it is you are lacking as the victim, as the prey, potential prey for them. And in my case, as someone who comes from a very large family, there would be limited opportunities for attention, I guess, love, also, I guess, any treats. But most importantly, in his case, what I remember was he, in the yeshiva center, there's a big backyard, and he had this old car. It was like a bomb, as we used to refer to it. And I remember the color now as well, light blue. And he gave me the opportunity to drive the car as an 11-year-old, 11 or 12-year-old,
wow,
in the backyard. And we did it a few times.
And so really you were thinking then, oh, this guy's great. He's like, you know, my best mate, and he's like my dad.
Yeah, I mean, there was a bit, you know, some weirdness to him that I never really knew about, but or couldn't really put down to understand. But I also felt that, you know, he's actually given me a lot of cool opportunities. Then, you know, if I have to put up with anything, I was like, whatever, it's okay. But I get to drive a car. None of my friends get that. I get to get treats, and I go, just the things that, to have the attention from an adult. Mm. So it was just things that obviously I was lacking. Perhaps I didn't even know that, didn't realize it at that time.
Of course. Okay, and so what was the nature of the abuse in the bathroom then?
I can say that it wasn't rape, thankfully, but it was... really, it's difficult for me to even talk about it. I mean, I've given police statements and, and discussions, but it was on the close fairly bad side.
Okay.
And, you know, just by the end of it, let's just say I had my undies and pants down my ankles. I was basically blacked out. I remember just getting up. I mean, I remember him naked. I remember me naked. I remember our private parts not being private anymore. And it was just, it was very, very traumatic. And
I mean, at that age as well, because you said very eloquently that you didn't have the language to actually contextualize what was happening to you.
Yes.
I mean, this is a personal question, but had you had sexual feelings by that? So you had erections? Were you aware of the sexual world at all?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, I can't say so unequivocally that I did or didn't. But I do know that I had no idea what was happening. It was just all alien to me. I wouldn't have had access to pornography or things like that. That came much later. So, you know, did I have a sexual thought at any stage? Did I have an erection at any stage? I don't recall having it, but I certainly recall that I didn't understand what was going on,
except to know that something
was wrong.
Okay. So how did you deal with that? Did you tell someone or did you just keep it to yourself?
Well, I remember leaving the place and going home straight away, not telling anyone initially. The abuse happened a couple of more times, at least twice more, in a different synagogue where we used to read the Torah, because this was at the Yeshiva Center. He used to read the Torah somewhere else. And at some point, I did tell a close friend of mine, my best friend at the time. I didn't go into the details, but I shared it in a broad sense. And a few days later, I guess in some ways I was testing to see how he would respond. I actually remember myself testing a little bit, so I can't remember what exactly I told him. But all I remember is that within a few days, I was being teased at school, being called pufta, gay, those types of words. And it wasn't just the words that was being used. It was I felt always that I was then being treated in a way that there was something wrong with me, that I did something wrong. And that was done in front of teachers, in front of staff members, in front of, you know, on the weekend we used to go to youth group events. I was shocked at how the fact that everyone knew, seemed to know about it. Corporal punishment was quite common in those days. I mean, it's different than, you know, to give a cane. I got a cane once as well, but I used to get belted at home as well. Pants down, boom. So I used to get home after, you know, during the time of the abuse. I used to come to their house, and my parents used to get advance information that I was suspended or kicked out of class. I used to see my dad as soon as I walked into the house, go upstairs to your room. I knew what was coming. My dad would get the belt out. My mom would sit on the bed, say, pull your pants down, your undies. And I used to get, you know, 10 beltings like that. That was often in the home, a very common way of a punishment.
But corporal punishment wasn't common in the 90s in Australia, was it? So that it was something that was still happening in the yeshiva, like it was the 1960s, basically.
In the yeshiva center, yes. It wasn't common everywhere across the board in the yeshiva center, but certainly for the religious children of religious groups. I remember a teacher getting a bag full of coins from the bank and just whacking a student over the head with that. I guess what I'm trying to say is that it wasn't uncommon to experience violence around you from the perspective of discipline. Well, at least that's what they felt they were doing, disciplining us children using violence.
So it happened three times, you say?
At least three times that I can remember, and that's what I gave the police statement. I made it very clear to him that I didn't want to do this anymore. I don't know what gave me the courage to do that. I wouldn't have said I don't want to do it anymore, but he understood from me that that was it and I wasn't going there anymore. So I was able to extricate myself from that position.
Do you remember him telling you not to tell anyone?
No. No, I specifically remember that he didn't say anything to threaten me or to keep silent. It was just a given. I was, as I said, I just felt so shamed and guilty about everything around it.
But then there was a second abuser as well.
He was a karate teacher. He was a member of the Chabad community, in charge of security. He was a black belt in karate. So a 12-year-old's hero in many ways, especially in our context in the community, where I remember any anti-Semitic incident or when non-Jews came to our property, Cyprus was there.
He was the hard guy.
He was the guy that we would contact, and we would sit there and watch him take on people twice his size and come out very proud and all of that. So it was someone that we looked up to,
And the abuse started in a very mild way, relatively mild. He'd pick me up and some of my siblings. He'd put the other people in the back of his van, and I'd be in the front. He'd make me sit in the front next to him. As soon as I'd walk in, I'd go into the car, even before I'd close the door. And even I remember some of my siblings sometimes were right behind me, and he had such brazen guts to do that, molest me like that, just on my clothes, quickly just touch my genitalia. And it just became common practice. Every time I came into the car, that's what he did. And he got away with it every time. So over time, I just became accustomed to it. It's part of the price that I have to pay for this. And
the price you have to pay for what?
Well, for hanging around with him, for going to his karate classes. I used to hang out with him a lot in the yeshiva center because we lived across the road from the yeshiva. I'd be playing basketball in the backyard, and because he was in charge of security, had access to all the offices and all that, he was just always around. So, and it was amazing to be around next to someone like that, because I guess people would know that he's kind of protecting me in some ways. Mm. But then I started acting out, responding to the abuses that were going on both with him and previously with Velvel. And
in what way?
Well, it was showing my parents saw that, you know, when I'd go into the house and start wearing, we weren't allowed to wear jeans even, and shorts and those types of things. Like, until a certain age, and I can't remember the exact ages, but those are the types of rebellious activities that I would have started with, but I wasn't interested in studying for my bar mitzvah. So I was rebelling in that way. Wasn't doing very well in school. But my parents decided to speak to the rabbis, and they all came to an agreement that if he's rebelling and he's not showing that he's religiously observant as he should, well, we need to infuse him with a whole lot more religious activities and environment. So I was sent to Israel, to Bnei Brak, which is the focal point of religious activity in Israel, that and Mea Shearim, which is in Jerusalem. And I went to a full-time Jewish studies cheder, it's called. They sent my brother and I, he was 1 year younger than me.
How old were you at this
point?
I
was 12 and my brother was 11.
Wow.
And that was the last time we had studied secular studies. We started doing religious studies from that age until the age of 18.
Wow. So 6 years full-time curriculum in Israel.
Well, no. So we were there in Israel for about 6 months or so,
okay,
for a period. But then we came back to Australia, and for the rest of the time, we just did religious studies as both a program with the Yeshiva Center. They allowed us to go in a little bit earlier, younger than some of the other kids. But essentially, that's what we did. Religious studies full-time from the age of 11 or 12. My brother was 11, I was 12, till the age of 18. Obviously, the religious environment and all of that didn't quite work the way my parents and the community leadership expected. Rather, I actually continued to rebel, I guess, in many ways, against the system. I forced myself to eat not kosher food. I forced myself to desecrate Shabbat, getting kicked out of school regularly, substance abuse, those types of things. And it was very clear that I was going down a very troubled path. And until the age of 18, I went back and forth, kicked out of a Melbourne yeshiva, went then in Sydney, kicked out of both places twice. And a lot of people actually just didn't understand the reasons. I thought I was just rebelling. And I just remember, as soon as I could get out of Australia, I got out of there. And that was at the age of 18, where I could go to Israel, the Israeli government. I met Aliyah, they paid for my ticket, and I just got to Israel. That's all I wanted to get, to escape, to run out of there, leave the community, with the intention of going to the Israeli army.
National service is something you have to do if you live in Israel. It's something that I guess you're brought up to maybe want to do in some circumstances, particularly young men. But it's not something, typically, that people leave a country like Australia to choose to go and do. If they're going to go and live in Israel, it wouldn't be to serve in the army, which is, yeah, pretty much the worst bit of being an Israeli citizen, isn't it?
Look, I mean, some Israelis absolutely look at it as a service and a duty, and they're very proud of that. I think, and this is more in hindsight, and I had the opportunity years to reflect about it, it was really a way to escape and to, in some ways, even reclaim my manhood, my masculinity.
I guess what I was getting at is it's almost like a kind of self-harm. It's putting yourself in harm's way, but you see it as something that was emboldening too.
Yeah, I still don't see it that I was putting myself, I mean, I wanted a bit of action, I'm sure. As an 18-year-old kid, you know, you're looking for a bit of action as well. But I think, you know, there were other important elements of, firstly, getting out of Australia, and then if I'm going to go to Israel, what am I going to do there? And I thought about going to the army or already for a while. My mum's brother, my uncle, had been killed in the Israeli army in the late 60s, but my parents weren't supportive. One is because my mum had lost a brother, but also because the Chabad community, certainly back then, it wasn't an any ultra-Orthodox community. They don't support going to the army. So it's not as if anyone supported me or suggested it. It was me, I think, just wanting to go and prove that I can just be physical and be the man that I needed to be and that's expected of me.
How did it go for you?
You know, I had the experience. I served in the territories. I did the training. I was in a Golani Brigade. It's an infantry unit. But then as a lone soldier whose parents lived overseas, you're categorized as such, I had the opportunity once a year to go overseas to visit the family. And at the age of 20, in 96, I went to Australia for my sister's wedding. And it was then that I heard about the issue of child sexual abuse. I'd been thinking about what had happened to me, obviously, probably on a daily basis and reacting to it in a number of ways, whether it's through physical activity or substance abuse or whatever it was. But it was really in my mind a lot, and there was a lot of anger. But when I heard on the radio from Australian police saying, if you have any information about child sexual abuse, we encourage you to come forward and share it, it was then that the penny dropped. Like, hang on, that happened to me. I instinctively went downstairs to my dad's office and told him about it. So we're talking about the issue of language and not knowing how to express what happened. I didn't even realize that I could go to the police. I didn't even really understand that a crime had been committed. Mm. I didn't really know what a crime was. To me, a crime was if someone steals, if someone murders, if someone does those things. But what is that?
How did your father react when you told him that that's what had happened to you?
He was supportive. He asked a lot of questions just to, he just wanted to confirm what it is I was saying. I mean, he was shocked by it, so he just wanted me to restate it. But to his credit, which is, he contacted the police straight away and informed them, which is very unique in the ultra-Orthodox community. In the vast majority of cases, and especially those that I've come across, the parents will put pressure on the children not to take the matter further for a number of reasons. It's about reputation for the institution, but most of the time it's also about protecting the interests of the family, their standing in the community, not to harm the potential marriage prospects for their siblings and other family members. So that...
Did you feel that burden too, that by telling the truth you might be endangering the position of your family within that community?
Because I'd already been out of the community for a couple of years, I didn't, and again, I didn't really even understand that I had to report it to anyone until then. So everything just went through so quickly.
Was that taken seriously straight away?
Look, I thought the police tried to take it seriously, but they went to interview the perpetrators. One of them, Velvel, the first one, was already in New York, so they couldn't. They interviewed the second one. He obviously denied anything happened. And they came back to me and said, due to lack of evidence, we are going to leave the case open, but pending further information. But at the same time, I also went to the rabbi, the head rabbi there, the late Rabbi Groner, and I didn't even have to say more than 2-3 words. He knew exactly what I was talking about, and he said to me straight out, you don't need to do anything about it. We are dealing with a case. And he told me later on that they were seeing a psychologist, and the chief rabbi himself was involved in the case personally, and he's monitoring. And he told me a couple of years later, he said, when I asked him, and Tsipras was still there standing in charge of security, responsible for kids after what they'd known that he had done, because obviously they believed it because they were treating him, quote unquote. And I asked him, you're keeping him in this position, access to kids, free access. Can you assure everyone that he's not reoffending today or that he won't in the future? And he said, no. I just walked out of his office that time and just, I couldn't believe it. And he was there until the late 2000s, for many years later.
I mean, obviously what you're talking about is very familiar from the stories we've heard of the Catholic Church as well.
Yeah.
But there's such an obvious contradiction, isn't there, between an institutional cover-up and an institution which claims to be making people virtuous.
There's one word that I use now that probably sums up for me the fundamental issues I have with both my experience in the past and today, what I see: hypocrisy. It is everywhere within the ultra-Orthodox community. And the reason I have a particular issue within that community, as in the ultra-Orthodox world, is because if they want to lead their lives in this way, fine, go right ahead. But if they put themselves up on a pedestal and claim to be a light unto the nations and try to recruit people to be like us, because we are the setters of morality and of religiosity, we are it. You see repeated hypocritical actions and views, not just in the context of child sexual abuse, but in all areas. And that's something that I just cannot put up with anymore. Just when I see it, it turns my stomach.
I should say what you look like physically. You have short hair. You're not wearing a head covering. You don't present as an Orthodox Jew in any way at all. When did that happen?
Well, at the age of 18, really, when I remember getting onto that plane. My parents took me to the airport. As soon as they went, I took my kippah off on a permanent basis for the first time ever. I got on the plane. I had a razor in my hand where I had small beard, like not even a beard, just some hairs on my mustache and whatever else. And because I was still in the Chabad community, I had to keep it. But I had that razor and I went after takeoff. I went into the bathroom in the plane and shaved the bits of hair that I had, not knowing at the time that I needed to use shaving cream. And I ended up bleeding everywhere. And I remember putting tissues to cover the blood and going back to my seat with a whole lot of tissues around me. So
how did that feel the moment that you took your kippah off?
Freedom. When I went to the airport and my parents dropped me off, and for me it was freedom. I'm leaving Australia, leaving my community, leaving my past behind in many ways. I felt free for the first time. I remember on the stop off on the way to Israel in Thai airport, I got my first cool haircut, so to speak, you know, because until then it was always just, you know, at number one or number two, short hair, standard, you know, all one size. But there it was, I was taking steps to become a normal, quote unquote, member of society.
And so when you came back to Melbourne when you were 20, did you look like you look now?
Yes.
How did your parents react to that?
Well, they let me stay in the house as long as I remained in the attic in the house and away from the other kids. Literally, there was an attic. We had to go up a primitive ladder. I saw that as they were being kind, because just the fact that they let me stay in the house was nice. But yeah, when you think about that, that was the intention, to segregate me so the younger kids won't learn from me. And I do understand them. Especially at the time when, as a parent, you're going through and trying to raise your kids to follow your footsteps, which is the, you know, religious lifestyle. And you've got an older sibling who, you know, a lot of them would have been looking up towards me for guidance and whatever. So that was an issue. So they wanted to keep me away. Once I got back to Australia, I had to catch up on all my studies, of course, because, as we said, I didn't have any secular studies from the age of 12. So I put myself into year 12 equivalent, VCE. I got that, which allowed me to go to university. I did a Bachelor of International Relations. You know, in the beginning, it was very difficult because my language skills were terrible.
And socially, I mean, meeting other students of your age, your frame of reference would have been so different as well.
I would sit there sometimes just saying, yes, yes, nodding to what they were saying, having absolutely no idea what they were talking about, in particular anything around TV and music. I mean, even till this day, I am completely clueless about many things. So yes, it was you had to teach yourself, and you need to actually make a conscious effort to do that. And I used to do that through, you know, for example, about the English language. I used to, at the end of a conversation when I didn't understand a few words, I used to walk around pen and paper, write a few words, go home that night, a few nights later, and just look up in the dictionary and write down the meaning of each of those words. And then after a few times, my vocabulary really improved.
Do you remember an example of one of those?
I do remember one word, and I was a teacher's aide briefly, even before I had any degree in one of the Jewish schools. They thought I'd be good because I've got so many siblings, so I helped out a number of kids with different issues, learning difficulties. So I was teaching one of the kids, and the word was indifferent. Mm-hmm. And I thought, indifferent, but not different. Well, that's completely wrong. That's not what it means. And it took me, I remember a while later, I was like, oh my God, I taught that kid indifferent was completely wrong. So it was basic words, some were even simpler. I remember writing my first essay in English. That would have been when I was 25, 26. I'd never read a book. That was my first time I read a book, because they forced me to read a book for English for class. All the books I'd read before were religious texts, which is why till this day I've got an issue with reading books. For me, books remind me of religious texts, because that's all I ever read.
And to cut a long story short, when you got your qualification, you ended up in a managerial position within a Jewish organization in Australia.
Correct.
And that was when you felt you had a voice and you could do something about it.
Yeah, well, I started engaging. I became the head of the Anti-Defamation Commission and combating anti-Semitism and racism, and I got to interact with the media. I worked my way up and I became the vice president of the Jewish community in Australia, the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. And that's when I felt, this was 2011, if I'm considered a senior leader in the community, I need to take a leadership role about this issue, because no one had until then, and I suspected no one else would do that. And I realized it was going to be very difficult, and I discussed it with my ex-wife. I mean, she was supportive, but she didn't have much of a choice, really. She saw that I needed to do it because I needed to get justice, I needed to protect children, and I was on a mission. And that's when it started. It was on the 8th of July, 2011. It was front page news in the Age newspaper in Melbourne. As a result of that expose, many victims went to the police, including about David Tsipras, my second abuser.
Was he still head of security at that time?
He was involved on various boards, the Council of Orthodox Synagogues of Victoria, for example. So he was putting himself, as often these perpetrators do, in positions of authority, so that when someone comes out and says, he sexually abused me, the victim has no credibility, but the perpetrator does. One of the first things I got was a lawsuit, defamation, from his lawyer, saying that he's going to take me to court. They gave me 30 days to respond.
Wow. How did that feel? Because you must have thought, in a way, we'll bring it on. Exactly. I'll take you to court because I've got the story.
That's exactly right. So initially I was shocked, but I spoke to lawyer friends and they said, look, truth is a defense. And that was the first time I'd learned that concept. And that's when exactly the words I said. I said, bring it on, because this is my day in court. The police didn't have enough information, anything like that. I said, okay, we'll take it to court. I didn't even need to worry about that, because over the next few months, about 15 victims went to the police about Tsipras himself. He was ultimately charged. He's now sitting in jail for 8 years. He got 8 years sentence for sexually abusing 9 children, including myself. There were others who couldn't go on with the case for a number of reasons, but we do know there are many other victims. There's no doubt dozens. Statistically, each perpetrator has over 100 victims. So we know that there would be many others. My first perpetrator, he's still in New York. In fact, I had last night correspondence with Victoria Police. I went
still in New York and practicing
as
a rabbi,
reading. He's got a day job, but he reads the Torah on the Sabbath and the like. And I tried getting justice. The problem is lack of evidence still, because it's my word against his word. And if he was in Australia, the police would investigate. The problem is they can't seek extradition just for that. So what did I do? About just over a year ago, I went with a friend of mine who was an undercover journalist. We got a recording of Velvol acknowledging that he had abused me. But what he did was he basically blamed me, even though he was about 25 years old and I was 11 or 12. He said, I'm sorry that I hurt you, but I did it because I loved you. I was taking the lead from you. So he was blaming me for the abuse. It's all on the public record now. So I gave that.
How did that feel, hearing that?
It was a tough weekend, you know, it was a tough few days before and a tough weekend after that. But it was also a relief in some ways, because I got some answers. And one of the questions I was seeking to clarify, is he a danger today? And I walked away from that. And anyone who saw the footage walked away knowing 100% that he is a current danger to children. But I provided that material to the police. They reopened the case as a result. Another victim has now come forward about that. So they've now got a much more robust case, but it's still a process. They've had it for over a year, and I just happened to speak to them in the last couple of days, correspondences, and they're dealing with it. It's just a long process, bureaucracy seeking extradition.
And as a result of this sort of snowballing inbox of people around the world getting in touch and saying, this has happened to me too, inside the Jewish community and outside, this has now become your job.
It has. I mean, it depends how you define a job, because I haven't been on a salary for the last 3 years or so, to be honest.
Let's call it your crusade then.
My crusade. It's
how,
my passion.
How does that affect you, though? Because what you're doing on the one hand is you're taking a bad experience that happened to you and putting it to good. You know, as a result of being involved in this crusade, you're helping hundreds of people who have been involved in a similar situation. No doubt about that. Yeah. But on the other hand, here you are with me reliving the whole experience again. That's what you're asked to do as part of that process on a constant basis.
Yes.
Which can't be good for you.
It's not good for me on the one hand. And Look, there are benefits and disadvantages to it. The benefit is it's part of the healing process in that I am taking something, a terrible experience, traumatic experience that happened in my childhood, and I'm turning it into a positive by helping so many others, whether it's victims of abuse, whether it's their families, whether it's institutions now. Jewish communities around the world, as a result of my work, have now got policies and procedures in place about this issue. It's now a topic of discussion. So, yes, I see all the positives. On the negative side, as you rightly point out, I relive it. I have vicarious traumas, and only my personal trauma, the vicarious trauma of so many victims who have shared their stories with me. Some of them are harrowing.
And some of them presumably are happening now.
Oh, absolutely. At the talk last night that I gave, someone came and shared with me very briefly their story, and I've become better at creating boundaries to protect myself a little bit better. So I experience that trauma as well. But whether it's a secondary trauma or the primary trauma that I've experienced, there is the impact, the ongoing impact. And I'd never realized what that was because I thought, you know, I was doing certain things, whether it's substance abuse or, you know, relationship issues, communication. I thought it just, that's my personality. But you start to learn that it is directed or comes from the abuse, at least part of it. And a good example is having grown up within the Chabad community, for example, going to therapy is something that was frowned upon. You go to therapy if you're messed up. Unfortunately, I learned the hard way in many ways because I was working way too many hours, helping too many people, neglecting myself and my family. And I had a very difficult few years in the last few years. Also, we had to leave Australia because of the responses from some of the leadership, including some of the most senior rabbis in Australia, Chabad officials from around the world, attacking myself, my family. My parents were forced to leave Australia.
In what way attacking?
Oh, Manny Wax wants to bring Chabad down. He's anti-religious. He wants to bring the institution down. He's exaggerating the abuse. He wasn't even raped. It was just molestation. Those types of things.
On the internet?
On the internet primarily, but in other contexts as well and behind our backs. And there was just, it's all on the public record where people actually, all they have to do is Google. I mean, even the head rabbi of the Yeshiva Center was yelling towards my, directed at me and my family, even though I wasn't there, my parents were there. Who gave you permission to speak out about this issue, to undermine his father-in-law, Rabbi Groner, by saying that he didn't deal with his issues, by putting our community under the spotlight and bringing it into disrepute as if I had done that and was responsible? So the leadership, not only the Chabad leadership, not just the religious leadership, the mainstream leadership as well, not only they didn't support me, in some cases, they even led the campaign against me and my family. That it was a few years of absolute misery and nightmare. But I just...
What's motivating that, do you think? Apart from wanting to protect the senior leaders within their own organisations, is it that because Judaism's a minority, there's a feeling of, well, if we're going to be in the media, it shouldn't be for this?
There are a few reasons. I think if we look in the Catholic Church and other places, they all try to cover up for the reputation of the institution. So I think that's the similarities across the board, whether religious institutions or sporting clubs and the like. We saw that in the US now with the gymnasts and the swimmers, exactly the same thing. We've got unique issues within the Jewish community where, for example, Holocaust mentality, we don't want to attract anti-Semitism. We don't want to give fodder to the anti-Semites. And if we say we're pedophiles amongst us, well, that will just add to that. Then there's the issue of disbelieving. I mean, people genuinely within the Jewish community don't believe that other Jews can behave like that towards children. And I had mainstream Jewish leaders who weren't religious. When I initially spoke out, they said, I never thought that it happens within our community. Not just child sexual abuse, also domestic violence often took a while, but that we already made headway in that regard a while ago. But ultimately, we had to leave. We went to France temporarily until we decided where we were going to go. And that's when a lot of the depression, anxiety, suicide ideation, I mean, even to this day, a lot of these things I still experience as I've been diagnosed with those things, take medication. I mean, these are things that are very difficult for me to say.
What is the one thing, if you could just choose one thing, that has to change about the way that society deals with the victims of child sexual abuse?
Well, the one thing is really the culture, because up until the last few years, it was really something about covering it up and not necessarily intentionally, because let's not forget, most child sexual abuse cases happen within the family environment, in the context, whether it's a family, a relative, a neighbour, a tutor, whatever it is.
Well, that's the interesting thing about your story, is that really, in a way, for you, the yeshiva was your family.
Correct.
You know, you're describing like an uncle type relationship, really, with a lot of these teachers.
Absolutely. And the fact is, so if we change the culture from being quiet about it and we just talk about it openly and discuss it, the perpetrators thrive on this code of silence that exists, not just within the Jewish community, more broadly. So we are seeing this progress. We are seeing this change. I would say that it's going to take a generational shift. I started this campaign in 2011. Where we are today is a world difference from where we were a few years ago. And I'm certain that in another 10 years, we'll be significantly more progressed as well. But of course, we've got broader society and we've got Jewish community. And within the Jewish community, you've got different segments. So the ultra-Orthodox community, the benchmark, that their starting point was a lot lower than where the rest of society was. So again, we're seeing significant progress there as well. But as we consistently see around the world, there are still cover-ups, there is still intimidation going on, especially within the ultra-Orthodox community, especially within Chabad. It's shocking, and it's more shocking to me that they still don't get it. And mind you, also, I think it's important to say, not just the ultra-Orthodox community, even the mainstream leadership, even in the UK here, when I bring matters to them, to their attention, they have consistently mishandled these matters. And it's appalling, because the way to change is through leadership. And that has been lacking, and I sincerely hope that with the work of so many people, myself included, we are going to get to that level eventually.
Manny Wax. If you'd like to hear more of his story, he has a book. It's called Who Gave You Permission? And he has a blog. There are links to both on our website, modernmanwithtwoends.co.uk. And if you've been affected by the issue of child sexual abuse, there are links that may help you on our website too. Still to come, our record of the week, and Alex Fox up next after this. It's time to talk about love and romance and sex with the goddess of sexpertise. It's Alex Fox.
The oddess of sexpertise, I would say.
What have you been up to this week?
I have been a guest at Eroticon, which is a convention of people who write and speak about erotic matters, such as me.
And not a series of sex emojis.
You can get sex emojis, of course you know. Can you guess what a vac cube might be, Ollie?
I mean, it sounds like a vacuum you put your cock in, but I don't know.
What, just for a quick spring clean of the peen? It's a big person-sized cube. It's sort of like a scaffolding structure, if you will, mm-hmm. that's covered in sheet latex. And you climb inside it, and then a vacuum is applied. They suck all the air out with a hose, and the latex tightens around you until you are held within this cube, immobile, and you can be suspended in the air if you want. And it's for people who are really into S&M and bondage.
Oh, I guess that, yeah, rather than for David Copperfield to produce in his next stage show. But
they also had one that was sort of a lay-down vac bed where people were stretching out on the floor and then having this latex sucked around them with a head hole, I should say. There are holes for breathing and seeing if you wish to.
Right, time for our listener question, which as ever is sponsored by our friends at mycondom.com.
Mycondom.com stock ID, juicy bubblegum and passion fruit lubricants. And the bottles look like something straight out of 1982. They're kind of like, they give me 80s hair salon vibes.
All right, yeah. Cyndi Lauper, pink bedroom.
Precisely, yeah. They look like what Cyndi Lauper would put on her cooch. So right. There we go.
Perfect. Right, and the question is...
Girls just want to have fun.
Well, girls just want to have cunnilingus, arguably, according to Charles in Canada, because his question is, I absolutely love going down on my girlfriend, as does she, but I'd like to be able to do it for longer. Currently, I can only go for about 15 to 25 minutes, which is enough to make her come once or twice, but I would love to be able to go for an hour or more. The problem is my tongue, mouth and jaw get sore and tired eventually and I have to stop. So are there any exercises or tricks for making those parts of my body stronger, tongue, mouth and jaw, stronger, so I can eat my girlfriend's pussy all night long?
Wow, Charles is ambitious when it comes to serving himself multiple portions of flange there, isn't he? He's very, very enthusiastic.
Greedy.
Or very giving, however you want to look at it. An hour is a very long time, although I'll applaud that because, as we've discussed in the past, most women need a sustained prolonged period of clitoral stimulation.
Fingers and ears, la la la.
In order to orgasm.
Yeah.
So to that end...
Not with me, Alex, just need to look at me.
To that end, I asked a pal of mine for tips, and maybe this is a little off-piste for the foxhole, but I had a chat to Dusty Limits, who is a fantastic male cabaret compere.
Do you know, I didn't
singer.
Need to have that described. The just, name's very evocative. I got an impression just from the name.
Well, he sent me a variety of mouth, jaw, and tongue exercises, which he uses himself before he goes on stage, and which he advises people doing any type of, as he put, oral exercise and or performance, just to do before they start the show, if you will. So, Ollie, maybe you want to give some of these a whirl.
Sure.
The first thing that Dusty said is that you need to loosen your jaw up. And he explained that a lot of people carry a lot of tension in their jaw. If you grind your teeth at night, that can be a problem. But a lot of us just do kind of bite down and clench a lot during the day.
I'm doing it now.
Yeah, I notice that I do it sometimes
before. Rubbing the back of my front teeth.
Yeah, yeah, before I fall asleep, I often suddenly become aware that I'm clenching my jaw, usually in anticipation of whatever the hell I've got to wake up to the next day. But yeah, if you are tense in your jaw, that can be uncomfortable if you're then doing a repetitive motion such as cunnilingus for a long time. So Dusty suggests, first of all, put both of your hands on your face as though you are copying the Edvard Munch painting The Scream, and then stroke fairly firmly downwards with the idea of just pulling your jawline forwards and down. Like if you just use the weight of your hands to drag your jaw down with those stroking motions, you should actually feel the back of your jaw gradually open up. A little bit like you're an anaconda or a python.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you do that for a while first.
Yeah. Warm-up exercise.
Precisely.
Yeah.
You're feeling warm now, Ollie.
Yeah, I've got my mouth's naturally hanging down a bit further, yeah.
I'm not going to make any comment about you hanging down. Next exercise from Dusty is to loosen the tongue. And he says you can move it side to side in your mouth. Precisely.
You said precisely. You looked a bit scared when I started doing that. My tongue was poking out. You're not just
you
in your mouth.
You kind of look like a Rottweiler on a hot day.
So just side to side in my mouth.
Yeah. Well, you can point it out if you want. He says you want to try and put your tongue as far forward in your mouth as is comfortable as possible to try and sort of activate those tendons and get blood rushing towards that muscle. So first you're doing side to side motions, then up and down again with your tongue forward, and then do clockwise and anti-clockwise motions. Dusty actually uses the word widdershins, which I haven't heard for a while. It sounds delightfully quaint.
There is a font.
He says if it helps you relax into the motion, you can make some noise. So you can go like, if you wish to.
I mean, we're beginning to get into unsexy territory now.
To be honest, I don't think any of this looks particularly seductive.
I suppose the idea is, though, perhaps, you know, if you know that sex is on the cards and it's coming, then maybe you could do this as part of your toothbrushing in the evening.
Precisely. I think this is a bathroom-based part of your routine.
Sound all right, wouldn't it, coming out the ensuite?
Yeah,
it's just a bit weird.
Gargle with your Listerine and do your Dusty Limits exercises.
A bit weird as you go down, I would say.
Well, it's only going to get worse in terms of non-sexiness, because his final tip is to loosen the lips by blowing first like a horse. So, you know, that's sort of like... then blow raspberries. So
that is so...
You sound like your son.
Sorry, that's the least sexy noise I've ever made.
It isn't particularly sensual, but it does help to loosen up the face, which Charles might find helpful before he gets in position with his lady friend. And that's my next tip, the position. Because although in his letter, Charles mainly focuses on how much his face sort of hurts after 25 minutes of repetitive exercise, a lot of people find that their neck and their shoulders or their whole body can get uncomfy if they're trying to hold one pose for a while. So it's a good thing to switch up positions when you're going down on someone. But there are also bits of kit that you can get, frisky frolic-based furniture that can help you, both you and your partner, be more comfortable when you are indulging in this.
Does it store under the bed?
Well, a
friend
of mine...
Flat-packed, ideally.
There are bits that will flat pack, but there are also things that have inbuilt camouflage, if you will. They're disguised as something totally normal and non-sexual, so you can legitimately get away with just leaving them lying around, even when you're not getting laid. A pal of mine, Kara Sutra, who writes a really good blog where it focuses on reviewing
sex stories. Your
friends
have very different names to my friends.
She recently reviewed this new product called the Kaziti Discreet Seat Queening Stool. Mm-hmm. Now, have you heard of queening before?
Sitting on someone's face?
Yes, sometimes involving scatological or water sports indulgent pleasures, but sometimes simply it's somebody sitting on another person's face so that cunnilingus can be performed. Mm-hmm. And this stool is made of tough, see-through perspex, and it kind of looks like something you might just have in your bathroom as a stool to sit on to do your makeup, or it looks pretty innocent.
It doesn't have a hole in the bottom.
Yes.
Well, then it doesn't look innocent.
The holes are on the sides, so you stand it one way during the day, so it looks completely and utterly unremarkable, and then you flip it around, so the hole is more suggestively positioned when you wish to use it as a specialist item.
Okay.
But it's something that's worth checking out.
No, absolutely. I'm going to Google it and see if I agree that it's as discreet as you claim.
Other things that Charles might want to try are introducing a toy, as any kind of standard vibrator will give him a rest and will also add to the stimulation of his partner.
That's a good idea. Bit of time out.
There are toys as well which simulate the feeling of oral sex, so he could give his mouth a rest but still continue that particular type of sensation.
Excellent.
Two of the most famous ones include Love Honey's Squeal, which sort of looks like a little, you know, those mini personal fans you can get. It looks a bit like one of those but with lots of little silicone tongues attached to it. One thing I will say about that is those that love it adore it, but definitely use it with lots and lots of lube, because otherwise you are repeatedly slapping yourself on the flange with little tongues that can cause quite a lot of friction dragging. No one wants that. There's another one by Lilo which is called the Aura. This is quite a different design. It has a silicone surface with a little ball bearing that moves underneath the silicone in a circular motion. So it's kind of a mock tongue, but in a very different way. Some people find with this toy that when they increase the pressure, when they push it harder against their body, that gets in the way of the ball bearing going round and stops the motion, which is sort of it counterproductive. It doesn't always work for everybody, depending on your body. But again, for those who love it, they adore it.
Good to know those toys exist as well for the gentleman who doesn't enjoy performing cunnilingus as much as Charles likes it.
I think it's important for me to state that as much as I give praise to Charles for his enthusiasm and for his desire to want his girlfriend to receive even more pleasure than he's already giving her, he should check that an hour of oral sex is actually what she wants. She might be perfectly happy with 25 minutes, and she may find that 60 minutes and above is actually too much for her. She's either getting a bit bored or a bit sore, or she might just get too used to that same motion. And that actually segues quite nicely into a final note on technique. Now, some people, when it comes to oral sex, they like the movement to be switched up quite a lot. Have you heard Prince's song Alphabet Street?
I don't recall that, no.
Well, one of the lines in it is, I'm going down to Alphabet Street. And lots of people have said that that's a reference to spelling out the alphabet on somebody's clitoris during oral sex, during cunnilingus.
Different shapes, yeah.
That is a good way of making sure that your mouth doesn't get tired, because you're producing, you're doing different motions with your tongue muscle and with your lips and your jaw. And for some women, it works really, really well, because they like that those different motions. They don't know where the tongue's going to land next, so it feels more exciting and the anticipation is thrilling. For others, though, they get off much better if the motion is one repeated singular kind of like lick or flick or whatever happens to work for them. As ever, and I know I sound like a broken record here, the key is communication. Ask your partner what they like, ask them what they want, take pleasure in listening and really learning to their response. And that's the way to have a damn good night in while you're eating someone out.
Thank you, Alex. If you have a question for Ms. Fox to resolve in next week's edition of The Foxhole, then you need to head down to our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, and click feedback.
And if you head on over to mycondom.com, you can get 15% off absolutely everything on the site with the code FOXHOLE. That's FOXHOLE.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this week's Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new manbassador. It's Duncan in Leeds, whose fiance Taylor wrote in to say, "We're getting married on Good Friday. We love the show. We listen all the time. I finally got round to buying you all beers for your good work. So please, Ollie, could you tell Duncan I love him so much? He's a wonderful man, and I can't wait to be his wife." Certainly can, Taylor. And I can go one better. Duncan, I now pronounce you manbassador for Leeds. Congratulations to both of you. Music now, and our theme is by the wonderful Django Django. Their North American tour kicks off in April. And this is our record of the week. It's called Dans les Mains by French-Canadian Jean-Michel Blais, and it's out now. If you're waiting for the vocals to kick in, they don't. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.